This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Virginia Beach in the state of Virginia is still in shock today after what happened yesterday when 12 people were shot and killed in a city building. Police have released the name of the alleged assailant who died in a shootout with law enforcement. Here is Virginia Beach Police Chief James Cervera.
The suspect, and this will be the only time we will announce his name, is Dwayne Craddock. He was an engineer with Public Utilities. He was employed with that department for approximately 15 years.
Chief Cervera also talked about the assailant's gunfight with police.
Once they identified him, he identified them, he immediately opened fire. We immediately returned the fire. And again, I want everyone to know that this was a long-term, lack of any other term, running gun battle with this individual.
And he said the suspect had an arsenal of weapons.
We did recover additional weapons at the scene. I'm not at liberty to tell what those weapons are at this time. We also recovered additional weapons at the suspect's home.
Virginia Beach City Manager Dave Hansen said as a municipal employee, the assailant would have had no trouble roaming the building, which he did, on his bloody rampage.
He was still employed. He had a security pass like all employees had, and he was authorized to enter the building.
11 of the 12 killed were Virginia Beach City employees. The name of the game for China today is retaliation. Beijing has increased tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. imports. They range from 5 to 25%. The move comes in response to Washington pushing to 25% tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. The U.S. and Beijing stepped up their trade battle last month when talks in Washington ended without a deal, as American negotiators accused the Chinese side of reneging on previous commitments. More news at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Mexico's foreign minister says he'll meet with U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo here in Washington next week to talk about tariffs. President Donald Trump has threatened to impose a series of monthly escalating levies on Mexican imports until Mexico steps up efforts to stop the surge of Central American migrants to the U.S. border. Mr. Trump's tariff warning has prompted a heavy wave of criticism from American business leaders and members of both parties in Congress. Acting U.S. Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan issued the latest warning about the Chinese telecom giant Huawei today. He was in Singapore for the Asia Security Summit.
Huawei is too close to the government. The integration of civilian businesses with the military is too close. China has national policies and laws where data is required to be shared. So when I look at that situation, that's too much risk for the department. We can't trust that those networks are going to be protected.
Others at the meeting also had China on their minds. One was the French Minister of the Armed Forces, Florence Parly, who said her government would not be kept from operating in the South China Sea, in waters that Beijing claims as its own.
We will continue to sail more than twice a year in the South China Sea. There will be objections. There will be dubious maneuvers at sea. But we will not be intimidated.
On North Korea, European Union Foreign Affairs Chief Federica Mogherini, also in Singapore, said Pyongyang needs to be assured that denuclearization is the right decision for it to make.
It might be necessary to give some security guarantees to North Korea. They should know that the goal is peace and denuclearization and nothing else.
The 57-nation Organization of Islamic Cooperation is meeting in Islam's holiest city of Mecca, with Saudi King Salman saying the world must fight the sources and funding of terrorism around the world. He also hit at Iran over recent sabotage attacks on two Saudi vessels off the coast of the United Arab Emirates and a pair of drone strikes on Saudi oil pumping stations. Iran has denied any responsibility. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani held their first face-to-face talks on the sidelines of the Islamic summit in Saudi Arabia. The rare political interaction at the highest level seems to be a sign of easing tensions in traditionally tense relations between the two neighboring countries. To keep up to date with all the news around the clock, you can always tune in to voanews.com online. There is also a convenient-to-use VOA News mobile app. Gene Randall, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin.
Bury Jonas Savimbi where he always wanted to be. It's something that it was well accepted. Hence, a multi-sectorial commission was then created so that this burial could come into life, and it's what many of people, many of Angolan citizens witnessed today.
Angola buries former rebel leader Jonas Savimbi Saturday.
We had gone to court to seek a court order so they would not reach the result until this had been resolved. And they just didn't have to pay that.
Malawian main opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera challenges the outcome of the recent presidential election.
I think his choice of Masisi was the last option that he had, and it was not really a desperate move, but I think he didn't have a pool of individuals that he could pick a successor from.
And former Botswana President Seretse Khama Iyankama quits the ruling party. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Sierra Leonean former Deputy Information Minister has expressed concern about the safety of his family. This after police officers reportedly forced their way into his home Saturday in the capital Freetown. Cornelius DeVoe, who is also the spokesperson for the main opposition All People's Congress or APC, says it appears the action of the police were to intimidate and harass him. When reached via a telephone link-up, Brian McCamara, spokesperson for the police, denied knowledge of the police presence at his home. And for the latest update about the tension between the police and the opposition party, I reached Cornelius DeVoe, spokesperson for the APC.
Four trucks loaded with fully armed policemen came to my house this morning at about 9. They surrounded the house. They came without any warrant. The house was locked, and they have forced their way into the house. And as I speak to you, they are in the house. Myself and my family, we evicted ourselves from the house when I got rid of the information this morning. And as I speak, I don't know the whereabouts of my family. I am also in a location that I will not disclose for fear of my life. I think my life is in danger. I am worried.
But I spoke with the spokesman of the police. He said he is not aware of any operation that you just described, and that he has yet to be briefed on that. Now, you said you reached out to the Inspector General of Police. What was his reaction?
He contacted our National Secretary General, and he contacted the Inspector General, and the Inspector General was very clear that he is unaware of such an operation this morning, and that as far as we are concerned, we have not dispatched any people or any group of persons dressed in police uniform or policemen to my house.
I also understand there were clashes between the police and APC supporters Friday. What happened?
Well, we were at the party office following the court ruling on the 16 petition cases. And then when it was announced that the leader of our party in parliament, Chairman Ramadan Ba, will not be removed, he has retained his seat. That brought some respite, and there was some kind of joyful outburst. And on that moment, we started receiving stones from a group of people who were being covered by the police, and they stoned us. And the police also aided and abetted them by firing tear gas canisters straight into our offices. They bulldozed into our offices, and they arrested over 250 of our party supporters who were there, including some senior functionaries of the party, and that includes the president of the National Youth League, who, as I speak to you, is in critical condition in police cells and is vomiting blood. And up to now, the police have refused him access to medical attention.
Well, some have demanded an independent investigation into this. Others are saying that the APC has decided to always kick against the government. It is your supporters who have been violent. Why aren't you restraining your supporters from unleashing violence in the capital, Freetown, and other places in the country?
Well, there are no reports of violence in any other part of the country except in Freetown. And we did not provoke the situation. As a party, We have been very cooperative with this government. A couple of days ago, our members of parliament approved all of the presidential nominees, which means that we want the government to function. So we approved all of the presidential nominees in the last 1 year. We have been very supportive of this government in parliament. We only have issues when it comes to constitutional violations. And apart from that, our local councils across the country have been very cooperative with this government, especially with regards to the trumpeted flagship project of this government, which is the free education program.
Talking about cooperating with the government has embarked on an anti-corruption measure to crack down on people who have stolen public funds. Your party has refused to cooperate with them. There was Bintumani 3 to address some challenges that the country faces. Your party refused to attend. So where lies the cooperation that you speak about?
We are not against the fight against corruption. And for us as a party, we believe that when we give a political appointment, it is not an open check to indulge in corruption. But like I said earlier, we have only had issues when it comes to adhering to the spirit and letter of the Constitution. And because we think that these commissions of inquiry are in clear violations of our laws, that is why we have refused to cooperate. And that stance of us is supported by the fact that no less an institution than the Bar Association of this country has gone to the Supreme Court to ask for an interpretation of Section 150 of the Constitution, which underlines the functions of the Commission of Inquiry. And up to now, the Supreme Court has not filed that case for hearing. You will agree with me also that when it comes to issues of interpretation of the Constitution, these are very important issues which should not be delayed.
Cornelius DeVoe is the spokesperson for the Sierra Leonean main opposition party, the APC. He spoke with me from Freetown. Angola has buried former rebel leader Jonas Savimbi in his home village Saturday. It has been 17 years since his death following a clash with government soldiers during the country's civil war. He was reportedly quickly buried by the soldiers in an unmarked grave after he was killed on February 22, 2002. Savimbi, leader and commander of UNITA, led a rebellion against the Angolan MPLA government. Officials say Savimbi's burial forms part of the new government's reconciliation move to unite the country. For more about Savimbi's burial, I reach Rebecca Nahenda, an independent Angolan journalist.
Well, 17 years since he died, he's being buried today because he always wanted to get buried next to his parents. That's, of course, in Lupitanga, in the community of Andulu Lupitanga village. And finally, after so many talks and cards on the table, the new government of João Lourenço officially decided to create a multi-sectorial commission. That's, of course, to work on the realization of the funeral of Jonas Savimbi, which took place today under the agenda of UNITA. That is why he got buried today. This is because UNITA needed to create its agenda, and according to the agenda and framework, they thought of June being the best month to do so.
Why did it take so long? Because I heard Aside Sakala, the spokesperson for UNITA, saying they've always contacted the government seeking to have the body of Jonas Savimbi returned to them for burial. So why did it take so long?
Oh, this question of why did it take so long, it's really a question that is being played around up until now. There are no concrete answers as to why it took so long, why after so many years, it's only now that they decided to work on reburying Jonas Savimbi exactly where he wanted to lay next to his parents. So it's a question that is still in the air, even here in Angola. No one has concrete answers to these questions, but all we know is that in the new government, everything was able to be sought out and his burial took place. So we can look into this answer as something of no agreement between the two parties. And when there is no agreement between the two parties, so definitely no conclusion can be set and no card on the table can be played so that the body could lay next to where he always wanted to be. So this question, Peter, it's a question that is also in the air. And up until now, no government official, neither from the ruling party nor from the opposition, which is UNITA, has to give us concrete reasons why his body was only reburied today.
What has been the general reaction of people in the country because of what he did, particularly in the rebellion against the MPLA during the struggle before he was killed?
Well, at the moment, everyone is really excited that Jonas Savimbi, apart from him used to being a rebellious leader, but now everyone is excited that everything is back into normal. This only represents peace and unity within our political party. So even today at the funeral of Jonas Savimbi, everything went well. Everyone rejoiced and everyone was there, especially those supporters of UNITA. And not only they were all there to say goodbye to Jonas Savimbi, so we can really say that everything went well and everyone is excited because it's a sign of peace within our government. And when there is peace in the government, there's also peace within the population. And everyone can look at each other as brothers and sisters, as Angolans trying to build each other and not as oppositions trying to break each other down.
What has been the position of the ruling MPLA as well as the opposition UNITA, a group that Jonas Savimbi led before his demise?
When UNITA went back to request for the burial, everything was well accepted. The president saw into it as something that they could not be denied. It was their right to rebury him where he always wanted to be. So the agreement between the two parties came up purely with no conflicts, with no whatsoever disagreement. It was the president, our current president, João Lourenço, when UNITA approached that they wanted to rebury Jonas Savimbi where he always wanted to be. It's something that it was well accepted. Hence, a multi-sectorial commission was then created so that this burial could come into life, and it's what many of Angolan citizens witnessed today.
Rebecca Nahenda is an independent Angolan journalist. She spoke with me from the capital, Luanda. Lazarus Chakwera, the presidential candidate for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, says he will not accept the outcome of the May 21 presidential vote. Citing what he says were voter irregularities during the tabulation of the results, the opposition leader says he will challenge the electoral victory of incumbent President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. The Electoral Commission declared Mutharika winner of the presidential election with 38.57% of the total vote cast, while Chakwera came in second with 35.41%. For more about his decision to reject the outcome of the vote, I reach MCP presidential candidate Lazarus Chakwera in the Malawian commercial capital, Blantyre.
I have just spoken to the nation and told them that I do not accept the results of that presidential election, particularly because the tabulation of the results have been fired in so many irregularities that we feel Malawian people have been cheated out.
Both local and international poll observers were of the opinion that the election was transparent, credible, and free. What is your take about that, particularly when you have rejected the outcome of the presidential election result?
Their preliminary statements were referring to how people lined up peacefully, orderly, and lawfully and voted. It does not make reference to how the results have been tampered with. If you look at what National Initiative for Civic Education, NICE Trust, stated when they had observers all across the country in 5,002 polling stations, they have indicated that the aftermath after the poll was taken, what happened, they cannot say it was free and fair. Even Public Affairs Committee, a quasi-religious grouping that has been there since 1992, when we transitioned from one-party system to a multi-party system, they too have come out publicly and said these elections were not credible.
So how do you seek redress? Do you have the empirical evidence to prove your case in court?
Yes, we do. That's why I made an announcement to the nation to hold their peace, because we are taking this matter to court. And we believe that justice will be not only seen to be done, it will be done.
What are the prospects, realistically speaking, that you will win at the courts, looking at the fact that there is no precedent in Malawi that a losing candidate supposedly goes to court and the court rules in his or her favor?
We will be making history. You must remember that there has been a precedent on the African continent when the Supreme Court of Kenya did that. We want you to understand that people want to see that the right thing is done and not just accept because somebody else has already been sworn in.
So if the court peradventure invalidates the outcome of the election, what happens next in your view?
In our view, when the courts do make determination, we will take it from there. I cannot prejudge them as these matters will be decided by them. And they will give direction like they normally do because there was a small precedent in this country when a member of parliament did take the Malawi Electoral Commission to court. And when the Supreme Court nullified the result, there was a rerun.
So what are you telling your supporters, those who feel aggrieved just like you but are not restrained, particularly when our incumbent president or the newly sworn-in president, Arthur Peter Mutharika, is calling for peace and unity among Malawians?
I have always preached peace. I have always preached unity. I have preached rule of law, and that's what I'm standing by. And I'm telling our supporters to remain peaceful and calm until these processes are concluded. I have just stated that, and I continue to state that. He may be preaching what you have quoted, but what he is doing is actually dividing this country because scores of people right now from government are being put on transfer because they were perceived to have been pro-MCP or coming from places that are predominant to MCP. It is not right. He preaches one thing, and that's all he has done all the 5 years in the past while he's doing completely something different.
Have you engaged the Malawi Electoral Commission, particularly Chairperson Dr. Justice Jane Ansah, to address some of these concerns that you have and to look into its books to ensure that all your concerns about tabulation being tampered with, among other rigging issues that you have, are addressed before going to court? And when do you plan on going to court, by the way?
In fact, we had been engaging her and the whole commission when we presented these concerns, and she brushed us off, in fact, told the world that we had never submitted anything, which was a complete lie, because we had. In fact, we had gone to court to seek a court order so they would not get the results until these issues had been resolved. And they just didn't have obey that. They went back to court and sought that the order should be suspended so they could announce the results, and that's what they did. And so we have no recourse but to go to the courts and seek justice.
Lazarus Chakwera is the presidential candidate for the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP. He spoke with me from Blantyre. Seretse Khama Ian Khama, the former Botswana president, has resigned from the ruling Botswana Democratic Party, or BDP, following sharp disagreements with President Mokgweetsi Masisi. Analysts say the resignation appears to be an overreaction, which could potentially undermine the electoral prospects of the ruling party in the upcoming October elections. Ruling party supporters say they received the former president's resignation with shock, especially when his father was the founder of the party. The former president has been at loggerheads with President Masisi over policy issues. For analysis, I reached Dr. Gladys Mokawa, senior lecturer at the University of Botswana.
I think everybody expected this to happen, or perhaps maybe people expected the current president to actually fire former president from the ruling party, because as you are currently aware, there has been some kind of, can I say, no misunderstanding. They haven't been that close ever since the assumption of duty by the current president to office. So there was a thinking that Khama was going to be fired from the party. So it came as a surprise to quite a number of people when Khama himself decided to actually part ways with the BDP.
Do you anticipate his decision to leave the party, possibly with his supporters, to affect the ruling party?
Yes, I mean, he's made it very clear in the last meeting that he had with his constituency in Serowe that one of the things that he wants to do is to make sure that the BDP really does have a dent during this coming election.
But do you anticipate the splintered opposition front to take advantage of this?
Well, I mean, quite a number of people are anticipating that to happen. But there are also other events that have been happening besides the fact that the ruling party has been going through a lot with these two not necessarily being closer. So some people, there has been some internal problems as well with the United Democratic Front or the Umbrella for Democratic Front that is actually one of the major opposition party right now. So the opposition itself, even with the internal problems that the BDP has been experiencing, have not been in a position to be organized and to really take advantage of the current issues that are going on. There has been fragmentation, there's been polarization within the opposition.
Do you think former President Ian Khama is regretting deciding to choose the current president to succeed him, literally handpicking him?
He clearly stated that, but the problem is not necessarily just... one of the regrets as well is the fact that he played hardball by trying not to have a successive plan in place in terms of who was going to take over the reins of power. I think his choice of Masisi was the last option that he had, and was not really desperate a move, but I think he didn't have a pool of individuals that he could pick a successor from.
What is your take on this when some are saying that his decision to quit the party was an extreme measure, and that why wouldn't he try to find an amicable solution to end the policy feud between himself and Masisi? And why hasn't elders in Botswana been able to resolve the sharp differences between the two gentlemen?
First and foremost, I think it is an extreme. I agree with those that say it's an extreme measure. It is extreme for me on the basis that this party was formed by his father, and it's basically their legacy. And for him to really just flash the legacy down, you know, the toilet, it's just inexplicable. You know, you cannot explain why he has taken such an extreme turn. There has been attempts to try to bring the two gentlemen together, and Khama himself has been the one who has not necessarily agreed to some of the terms that were put forward by the elders of the BDP. The elders of the BDP have come to try to bring the two together, and Masisi has been trying to reach out, and they are people, but Khama has not been interested in meeting up with Masisi. So we don't know whether it was going to be possible for the two to come together, but no one anticipated that Khama would lead the BDP.
What do you see the prospect of the ruling party in the upcoming elections?
I'm quite positive that the ruling party is going to do well, because the row between the two leaders, I don't think it's at a political level that it has affected the BDP. Well, the president, Masisi, after the meeting in Serowe, had a meeting in another village close to Serowe. And, he was endorsing his VP as a candidate for elections in that area, in the Boteti area. So quite a number of the BDP members seem to be united and they were there to support. So there isn't an indication that the conflict between the former president and the current president has actually fragmented the BDP to a point where we will see the BDP doing so dismally badly in the coming elections. So I think that the BDP still has a chance of taking over the reins of power in the next coming election.
Dr. Gladys Mukawa is a senior lecturer at the University of Botswana. She spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, St. Augustine's Past Students Union, or APSU, held a fundraising gala last week at Camelot in Maryland, a few miles outside Washington, D.C. Organizers say the event was meant to strengthen the bond between the old student and the school back home. Located in Cape Coast, Ghana, St. Augustine's College is the first secondary school established by the Catholic Church. Two special guests at the gala, the patron of the school, Gabriel Charles Palmer Buckle, the Archbishop of Cape Coast, and Mrs. Alice Marie Ajiman, a former headmistress of Holy Child and a former teacher at St. Augustine, stopped by the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. I began by asking them about the observation of the ceremony. Thank you very much, Gabriel Charles Palmer Buckle, the Archbishop of Cape Coast, and Mrs. Alice Marie Ajiman, a former headmistress of Holy Child and a former teacher at St. Augustine's College. You were at the gala last night. Mrs. Ajiman, let me come to you. What were your observations from a teacher's or a headmistress point of view?
From a teacher's point of view, first of all, you know, like I said, you had gone to St. Augustine's from all over Ghana. You came from all over Ghana, and it was like making friends. It was like a mini UN.
Right.
Some of you had not seen one another probably for more than 40 years. So there was so much excitement, you know, unity of purpose was there. You had come to celebrate something, and you were so much full of passion for the celebration, and you were very happy, and I liked that spirit.
Let me come to you, Archbishop. From a pastoral point of view, what did you see last night?
What I saw was an affirmation that Catholic education has succeeded in bringing minds together, nurturing them, giving them values, and creating a certain bond between them. Because I looked at all those who were there, different age groups, different religious affiliations, different, I'm sure, political affiliations, and different ethnic affiliations or backgrounds from Ghana. And yet there was this camaraderie, all because everybody felt Augusto. And they said, Apsu, action in Kutsenyi. So there was this joy that was infectious and made me feel it was worth giving them the education they got in St. Augustine's College.
Mrs. Ajiman, let me ask you, looking at what you observed in terms of the enthusiasm and the bond you saw, how can this be translated into a strong partnership with the school as well as the students?
There has to be a unity of purpose. You must understand what you want to achieve. As I said, you need to be role models for the current students. You need to mentor them, and you need to meet the headmaster and discuss what you want to do. This is the beginning. So you are so much full of enthusiasm and passion. So if you can nurture your spirit of commitment and dedication, a lot can be achieved. I'm saying this because, yes, St. Augustine still remains a Catholic institution, but so much has changed. The kind of discipline that prevailed when you were there, I'm not sure the same kind of discipline is present in the college. And, you know, there's so much corruption in our society. And it is through mentoring that you can help these children turn around. I remember one time Ken Ashibe was there as the chairman for one of the speech day programs. And when he's an old boy, and when he stood to talk, he said, hey, say no to homosexuality, say no to Sakawa, say no to this, you know. And I found it so encouraging that somebody from outside should be telling the students, these are our values, don't go here, go there. I was inspired, I was motivated. You know, sometimes you don't need an army to tell us the right things that should be done. One individual can do a lot. I was talking to an old boy who is a professor at the University of Cape Coast. And he said, if we had about five people like Reverend Father Pierre, who is a chaplain of the school, Augusto will see a wonderful transformation in terms of the character of the students, in terms of the attitude towards studies, in terms of holistic, you know, educational values. So it all depends on you. You have just started. The joy is there. The commitment is there. The ambition to move your college forward is there. So plan something together. Meet the headmaster, discuss with him, and he will give you directives. Yes, because he's the man on the spot. He has his own challenges.
Right.
And he'll be very much grateful and enthused that APSU North America are there to back him. And like you said this year, to reignite your ethics and values.
Archbishop, talking about ethics and values, you have been a teacher yourself before. You are an Archbishop now. You are a patron of the school. What can you do in your capacity to help restore some of these values?
It's definitely a big responsibility, and I begin by saying thank you to the whole APSU fraternity, APSU Global, APSU International, if you want to call it, already for, one, organizing itself,
right,
because that already shows a certain desire of wanting to put back into the soil something of which you all received. In a conversation at the launch of the 90th anniversary, speech day last month, I think, I told them that we should now move from just being APSU, a feeling of wanting to put back something, moving from stakeholders to becoming owners. You know, education is supposed to create in a person a culture so that it's something that the ethical values, the religious values, the virtues of honesty, hard work, self-discipline, and, no to corruption and the rest, should become something you do naturally because it is good and it is profitable for a greater good. So I'm looking at it from this point of view that definitely the teachers are going to do what they can do, the staff, the headmaster would like to do what he can do, the chaplains will be doing what they can do. But we may now have to start targeting the various stakeholders or even role players in the educational setup, so that we work together, we synergize. One, the student himself must be also a player because he's a stakeholder in his own formation and transformation. Two, the headmaster, the teachers, that is the institution of the school, would have to have clear guidance what they need to do. They must have, they have a mission statement and they have a vision. And that must be the mission statement and the vision of the church for holistic formation. Three, I think parents and guardians are also stakeholders who should even be helped to move from being stakeholders and therefore demanding things to becoming owners of the formation of their children, the school. And therefore, they want to put in nothing but their best.
Gabriel Charles Palmer Buckle is the Archbishop of Cape Coast, and Mrs. Alice Marie Adjimane, former headmistress of Holy Child School in Cape Coast. They spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from MC Galaxy featuring Davido with Neck on Neck. And then Angel Mary comes your way with No Stress. Dibange follows with Be With You. And then Monique Seka with Okaman. And then we top it off with Awile Longomba with Get Le Coin.
But like King Kong, hey. He ain't Calabar, he ain't Calabar, he ain't Calabar, he ain't Calabar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, you're a piece of a cake. I'm gonna want to say,
confere citizen, I shall go bastard, Abanaya. Why? Because I'm mandiong on some that's a funk kirong skin. So she's easy for me, easy for me. Now me, they sing song. I'm bad like King Kong. Hey, hey, Calabar.
Moyo wangu tumia na siwezi Be weak, not the way
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the lion does not turn around when a small dog barks. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.